Right, welcome back, everybody. We're talking with William Henry about his latest book, The Judgment Day Device. Really interesting conversation, and there's so many aspects to the findings, of course, in William's new book, and a lot of the connections with the what's happening basically within geopolitics and how they're playing this. And as William said before, it's all very, very conscious, perhaps, or it's very, very under the surface and maybe subconscious of what's happening. But there's a few more things I want to ask you about as well when it comes to some of the symbolism. If we go back to Israel again, we talked briefly about the how they're using these Operation Pillar of Cloud and everything else. But there's another, the weapon manufacturing, something called David's Sling, and one of the Israeli companies, weapons manufacturer, are kind of teaming up with Raytheon to produce some kind of new shield or something like that. Tell us about this, William.
Right. So what we have is the Israeli government created a project called David's Sling that they also called Magic Wand. And it's an Israeli Defense Forces military system, as you mentioned, jointly developed with Raytheon, that's like a shield that's designed to intercept medium to long-range rockets and other missiles that were being lobbed at Israel, most recently by Hezbollah, and also as a future defense against possible attacks from Iran or elsewhere.
Really interesting stuff. And then we have, if we go back to Barack again, Barack Obama, of course, and this is something actually mentioned in the Bible. Barack in Hebrew actually means flash of light, I believe. Isn't that right?
Barack is a Hebrew word that means flash of lightning. And it's also used in Islam. Al-Barak is the name of the magic horse upon which Muhammad ascended into the heavens through seven halls or holes, ultimately going to the throne of God.
Yeah. Let's go back to the throne a little bit more. I want to ask you more about this because there's been various interpretations. You discussed a little bit of the ideas of the, you know, Ezekiel's wheel and everything, and we know about, you know, the ancient alien theory and everything else, and it's always interpreted as being some kind of flying machine, a UFO and everything else. What's your take on that, William? Tell us about that.
Right. When you peel back the onion or the veil, if you will, covering the Ark of the Covenant and get beyond it as a golden box, as a simple container, again, you're confronted with the biblical descriptions of the Ark as the footstool and the throne of God. And what you learn immediately is that this throne flies. It's a vehicle upon which this God being, Yahweh, who's described as rainbow-like with flashes of lightning, manifest, but also upon which he apparently travels the stars. And that's an amazing, amazing concept. And as I'm fully acknowledge in the book, it's completely different from the traditional view of the Ark. But again, what my research revealed is that there are those two trends about the Ark. It's either considered the container or it's considered the throne. And when you follow the throne stories in the Bible, you're led to this conclusion that the thing is some kind of an ascension vehicle.
What are the symbolic similarities with, the Noah's Ark, basically? We hear a lot of things about the Ark, and I've heard people like Jordan Maxwell before talk about the Ark of the Contract, which allegedly is the Egyptian root of this, that they had their own version, if you will. Do you think that all these are related and pretty much talk about the same thing, or again, can we read something more symbolically into the Ark or not?
Well, I do trace the Ark symbolism back to Egypt, as many have, and show examples in the book. For example, at the Temple of Ramses II, beside the Osirion at Abydos, you'll see the clearest depiction on a temple wall of Egyptian priests carrying an ark-like device, which is a power box being carried on two poles. I mean, anybody can look at that. If you've seen the Indiana Jones movies or any of the other traditional takes on the Ark of the Covenant, you'll look at that and go, that's the Ark. But there are also depictions of ark thrones in Egypt as well. If you go over to the Temple of Dendera, the Temple of Hathor at Dendera, you look up on the ceiling, you see the gods who were encouraged to believe were mortals, who became celestial beings. they're riding on what is called the arc of the millions of years, also called the bark of eternity. But here's the, again, that arc terminology being used. And what we see are these celestial beings sitting on a throne that is attached to the arc of the millions of years. Now, here's the thing about these depictions at Dendera, Henrik. One, they show these celestials as riding in the stars on thrones, and the shape of the arc of the millions of years precisely matches the way modern science portrays a wormhole. And when I put all this together, I'm thinking, well, okay, then they're clearly showing the other form of the Ark of the Covenant as this ascension throne or vehicle through which the celestial, meaning non-physical, energetic, but apparently humanoid-type beings, are able to travel the stars by opening stargates and wormholes with this device.
Tell us about the connection to the Merkaba.
The Merkaba is a incredible concept. It's Jewish mysticism that has its roots ultimately in the Sumerian stories of Enki, this master craftsman who is believed to have had a hand in tooling human DNA and sought to up-level us on the spiral of ascension. The word Merkava means throne chariot or throne mysticism. And the throne of the Merkaba is portrayed in Jewish art and indeed Judeo-Christian art as a flying vehicle, usually portrayed as some kind of a box-like device, as in the famous example of Ezekiel's flying vehicle. It's a box-like device with four wheels called ophanim that are attached to it. These wheels often are winged, giving us the impression or conveying the idea that this Merkava throne, in fact, flies, as we know it does. It's the ascension vehicle of these mystical beings.
So this is I think you referenced this as basically as an organic light vehicle.
That's the thing, because a lot of the UFO types, your ancient aliens types, your ancient alien theorists, they have the impression that these ancient craft that we see are like flying Toyotas, like advanced flying Toyotas or something. They seem to have this perspective that these ancient god beings were aliens, angels are aliens, and that this is all about high technology, that they're flying around the Merkaba in their perspective. When they interpret artwork that shows the Merkaba, they call it a flying saucer, inferring that it is a metallic technological device. The mystic literature that's attached to it, if they were to read that and then interpret their artwork, would know that what they're describing is in fact an organic or living being. It is in fact a vehicle that is manifested from the bodies, from the spiritualized bodies of these mystics and prophets. They, in fact, become this living, organic vehicle.
William, tell us if the throne of God, the kit, basically these things that need to be composed or put together or assembled in some way, if you believe that all these things are present on our world, on this planet right now, or if there are some components to this that we might look elsewhere for.
Well, at the end of my book, The Secret of Sion, I came upon these Russian Last Judgment images that showed the return of Christ. That's what the Last Judgment refers to, is the return of Christ. He's clearly shown in some other realm beyond the earth plane. He's in fact, enthroned in the heavenly Sion, which is the name of the location of Christ's throne. I happen to, based on my interpretation of ancient myths and legend and getting some inspiration from the Mormons, I locate the heavenly Sion in the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And so as I'm piecing this together, I'm thinking, okay, this Russian art is clearly showing the complete Judgment Day device, which includes the Ark of the Covenant and the Tree of Life or cross, the Rod of Enlightenment, the flask of anointing oil that transforms us into angels, the flask of manna in the holy book of secret knowledge. They're clearly showing this complete device as being located beyond the earth plane. It's also shown being protected or guarded by angels. In fact, the Quran says that the angels took the Ark of the Covenant and angels will return the Ark of the Covenant to earth at the proper time. these clues suggest to me that this complete device is not on Earth, although it could be manifested on Earth. And that's the hope and promise, is that if we can learn the true secrets of the real Ark of the Covenant, or the real secrets of the true Ark of the Covenant, the complete device, then it's one of those, if we build it, it will come type scenarios. It's the field of dreams kind of thing. If we can begin to imagine it and visualize it and assemble it in our consciousness, then we can manifest it on the earth plane. That's the hope and promise of the Judeo-Christian tradition concerning this device.
So the placing of the cherubim or these angels on the ark might be actually primarily symbolic then, to give an idea of what the source for this actually is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the two cherubim on either side could in fact be these other dimensional beings, higher vibrational beings, probably actually seraphim, who are the highest order of angels and who dwell at the throne of Christ. And by the way, the de' Medicis during the Renaissance proclaimed that the seraphim were transformed humans, humans who have achieved the ultimate human transformation and have become seraphim, beings of pure light and pure love. It's they who are the guardians of this device, they who will return with it, and it is probably they who ultimately brought it to Earth millennia ago.
Interesting. I didn't know that about the de' Medici, because, I mean, I've said this before, but if you go in and look at the rank, if you will, within the seraphim, if we get to this interesting point where a lot of them are associated with these... One-third of the angels that actually fell. We're talking about Lucifer, among others. They're several.
The sons of God, right, yeah, the Watchers. Yeah.
That's right. So do you think that this is obviously part of a bigger story of telling us something? How far out do you go here? Do you think that this is, again... let me do an example, because you mentioned Mormonism before. If we look at some of the sci-fi that's been created heavily steeped in Mormonism, we get things like the show Battlestar Galactica, which also is talking about a journey, if you will, of mankind seeking a planet in this case. But this could be interpreted as being either seeking Earth or seeking a holy place, basically, which could be the center of our galaxy. Do you think that this is a story of us ultimately, or is it of another race that we've basically encountered, this angelic race? What do you think, William?
That's an awesome question, and one I think about a lot. And it refers back to your comment a moment ago about the mighty ones, the sons of God, who are the offspring of this angelic race. We can identify the mighty ones. They were made mighty because they wore a cloak or a garment that made them mighty ones, and this garment was transmittable. And they who attain this garment of light, also called the star body, the resurrection body, the rainbow body, the body of light, these are all terms that refer to this. It's the next level of human evolution. All who attain that can join that race, who are referred to by Jesus as the immovable race of the perfect light humans. That garment of light that identifies this mighty race is the same garment that's sitting on the complete Ark of the Covenant, the Animatia. And what it tells me is that the Ark of the Covenant, this complete Judgment Day device, is probably a relic of this race, and or a device that belonged to this race, a sign, a seal, a tool, an appliance of this race. And as we attain the status that's capable of making or identifying and then possibly even manufacturing such a device, we bump ourselves up the evolutionary ladder. We go from type zero status, where we presently are, to at least type two. And I believe that this advanced race are at least type two beings, probably type three, maybe even type four beings on the Kardashev scale.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And this goes back to the ideas as well that this device is also a free energy device. You said we end up in a scenario where we're not going to be dependent on fossil fuels or even solar panels.
Exactly.
Anymore.
Exactly. Now we become more galactic beings like the Type 3s and Type 4s. We're able to open stargates and wormholes. We're able to dematerialize ourselves into beings of light and then ultimately remanifest ourselves as physical beings if we choose to in this plane by putting on and taking off cloaks and garments of light. That's why they're symbolized by this cloak of the mighty ones. I wrote a book about this a long time ago called The Cloak of the Illuminati, because it's the symbol of these illumined beings, and it's the ultimate secret that they, the cabal, the Illuminati, whomever, don't want humankind to acquire this knowledge, because then we're no longer slaves and sex objects.
Yeah, that's a great book, by the way. I have a copy about it many years ago. Really enjoyed it. And the question is then, we go back to this idea, we're talking about advancements of human beings. We need to step up to another level. We're talking about a spiritual transformation, a mental one, if you will, because we can always go back to that idea. Are we ready for something like this? A free energy device? We've talked about weaponry and the violent tendencies of at least many of the leaders out there in the world, as well as we've been detailing now about the situation between Israel and Iran and everything else. But something obviously needs to change in us before we would be ready for this type of an energy device, which would change so much, William.
Yeah, the term that the ancients use is we have to become more righteous beings. We have to become more, we have to become good, pure, godly beings. Like Cathars are exemplars of this. The Zadok, the sons of Zadok, the sons of the righteous one, are the righteous ones. Are they who assembled this device in the past? And over again, when you see references to it, there's references to living just and upright lives. And this means we follow the commandments. We love with all our hearts, all our minds, all our soul. We love our brother just as ourselves. That's the primary, those are the primary commandments of they who are able to make, identify, and ultimately assemble and utilize this technology. Because, you know, it sounds new agey, but the force that makes the arc work is love.
And, okay, and that's interesting because you mentioned that Ahmadinejad was actually, he was talking about these things on his UN talk, right?
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah, he clearly laid out his whole kind of, excuse me, New Age manifesto of of the emergence of most New Age people. At a, you go to any kind of metaphysical expo in the United States, and they'll be talking about ascension and the age of perfection and loving one another and loving the earth. Well, this is exactly, these are the exact terms that Ahmadinejad is using in his speech at the UN, as he's describing the emergence of his Messiah, the Mahdi, the perfect one, who will create this righteous civilization based on resurrection and the perfection of the human being. Well, you know, Hitler had a vision of the perfection of humanity, too. He called it the master race. We don't know if Ahmadinejad is more Hitler-esque or if he's talking in terms of the way the ancients understood the word perfection, which meant becoming more whole, becoming more holy, becoming more complete, becoming more compassionate beings, beings of light and love that can activate our latent capabilities and perfect ourselves, meaning become beings of light.
Hmm. Interesting. And that's a good point. You mentioned that as well, because there are, it always depends on what side of the fence you're on and standing and talking about these things, because there, I mean, there are many of these ideas that some people, I think, consciously kind of stay away from in within the New Age, because they hear, you know, resonance from what previous people have said. And although, again, no matter how well-intended someone is, things have gone awfully wrong in history. And so is there a way for us to change that programming? Is there a way for us to approach this subject or aspire to these things on a global level, you know, truly everybody?
I think so, Henrik. And this is, again, what inspired me and motivated me to write the book, is this idea that we can unite Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Not that we create one religion, but we can find the similarities between them and get individuals from these religions to cooperate. One of the most incredible things that happened while I was writing the book, it really plays with your mind because it's such a heavy subject. And in part, I'm researching this going, well, does Ahmadinejad really know all this? And if he doesn't, am I in fact helping him? You know, is he going to read my book and go, oh, that's what we needed right there. Okay, you know what I'm saying? That's
right.
Come from an ego point of view, but you think about these things. And you wonder, what's the impact of what's really going on in our world? Well, during this time, there was an Israeli graphic artist who got a bright idea to create a Facebook poster that says, I'm Israeli and I love Iranians. And he got friends to start doing the same thing. The next thing we know, there's Iranians who are copying that. They're also making Facebook posters that say, I'm Iranian and I love Israel. And the bottom line was, what came out of this is that, and there were thousands, tens of thousands of people that participated in this. And what came out of that is the realization that the people of Iran and Israel, and certainly the people of the United States, they don't want war between the religions.
Sure.
They don't want, it's the politicians and the military people that want this. And that's where it has to change. And this is why we have to get individuals expressing their own inner power and making their decision and making their voice known. This is the age that we're moving into now, is the age of personal empowerment. We all have the ability to search the web, to go on YouTube and empower ourselves mentally, physically, spiritually, and emotionally.
Yeah.
We can even begin to augment ourselves potentially with technology, with implants and things like that that are coming online. I wouldn't go anywhere near that, but my point is that we're entering into an era of the empowerment of the individual. The power of the state is going away. The power of the United States government can be brought to its knees by a genius hacker in India who could bring the earth grid or the American electricity grid to its knees.
Yeah.
And that's the age that we live in.
That's right. I completely agree with that. I think that's a perfect assessment of the situation. And the bigger and more paranoid these institutions grow, these governments, ultimately the worse it's going to get for them, I think. I think they're, although they're working against, well, they are working against an incredible force in the timing of everything that we're in currently, and they're trying to become more monolithic, more growing themselves more centralized and more larger. And ultimately, I think that's their own demise for not to, you know, actually being in contact with reality pretty much in nature, you know?
I agree. And so this is where it becomes really tricky, because this old beast is going to want to maintain control. And one of the most powerful controls, of course, is religion. And this is where we set ourselves up for a sham messianic figure, the appearance of a fake Christ Messiah or Mahdi that's presented by the media as the figure with these fake relics and all this kind of thing. And that's something that, you know, it sounds highly speculative, but it's also possible. Is you see how they're able to manipulate events and individuals.
How would you, William, be able to, what would you look for if you wanted to tell the difference, if it's, you know, the real thing or not?
Well, what I would, first of all, if I've got a figure proclaiming himself, he is the Christ Messiah or Mahdi, let's just stick with the Christ or Messiah, then that figure knows the secret of redemption and resurrection. In fact, according to the Jewish legend, one of the things that the elders of the synagogue in Jerusalem will ask the Messiah to do is to raise from the dead someone they had known personally. So there's one marker right there that this figure, and what will happen according to Jewish tradition is the Messiah will say, no, I'm not going to raise somebody from the dead. Instead, I'm going to reveal the secret of redemption, and he's going to demonstrate how he's able to dematerialize the physical body into light and then remanifest in a physical body, because that's something that these perfect like humans have the ability to do. So that's the criteria right there. So any wannabe coming down the pike has a very specific criteria that has to be fulfilled. And that's how we'll know, and that's how I will know if this is the actual figure.
Interesting. Now, tell us about the throne. Throne of God and the sun, the connection there, and increased solar activity. What is that about?
One of the things that I found in the Judgment Day device is these, and put in the Judgment Day device, are these amazing depictions of the throne of Christ, that which is the throne of the second coming. And again, it goes back to, these are similar to the Russian Last Judgment images, where we see this umbilical cord linking Earth with the celestial throne. And these images are often divided into zones, like we're walking up a stair or that we're going into higher zones or frequencies. And what we see in this imagery is Christ enthroned. We see the etymesia, the throne of the second coming, the Stargate device, if you will. And then coming from that throne is very often an image of a fiery river. This is referred to as the river of life. And it's described as this energetic connection from the throne of Christ to the earth plane. Now, of course, and here's our dichotomy coming back again. Christianity thinks of this as the river of hellfire, and you don't want to go anywhere near this river of divine fire, even though it's coming out of the throne of Christ, because it's going to fry you, okay? But the esoteric tradition says, no. What you want to do is prepare yourself to bathe yourself in this charged energy or this charged fire or vibration coming from the throne, because in fact it will raise you to a higher level of vibration. Well, as I'm looking at these images and studying this river of fire flowing from the throne, I'm suddenly then watching or looking at the news in 2012, and I'm learning from NASA that they've discovered these X portals and magnetic flux ropes coming out of the sun. Every 8 minutes or so, our sun opens up, and this, what's described as almost like a serpent rope of charged particles emerges through that portal linking Earth with the sun and sends these charged particles to Earth. And as I'm looking at these NASA artist concept of these flux portals or ropes of these charged particles, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, this looks exactly like this Christian art, Last Judgment art, showing Christ's throne. And in fact, in some of these depictions, Christ's throne is very sun-like. He's portrayed in a circular orb that's filled with light as if he's sitting in the sun. And I began to wonder if it's possible, if Christ's throne is not in fact in the center of the galaxy, as is possible, but is rather more localized. It's in fact the sun's throne is our S-U-N. And what these Last Judgment images are portraying could well be interpreted as our sun going suddenly crazy and releasing these storms of charged particles coming at the Earth. Well, what do you know? That's exactly what NASA is deeply concerned about right now, is the possibility of coronal mass ejections spewing these charged particles at the Earth and potentially destroying our technological civilization.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Now, there is, as you mentioned, always a two sides to it. We have the esoteric interpretation and then the exoteric, the full-on, the literal, so to speak. And that seems to go, not in all cases, but in most cases, with the example you just took. It's one tradition say, stay away from, you know, whatever it is. And the other tradition says, no, that's what you actually want in this case. And that seems to be the battle within the Bible overall. It's all depending on how you actually read it and what kind of interpretation you do of it. And therefore, to me, William, it's not so much about, let's say, an actual being or a person representing the Christ or the Antichrist, but it's about the choices that we make. I mean, biblically, it talks a lot about, you know, life lessons, and there are a lot of teachings and lessons, if you will, within there. And it's, to me, more and more just it's relating about the human experience as we all go through it as human beings. And we have to constantly make this choice, if you will, of if we want to go right or left, if we want to go, you know, for the esoteric or the exoteric. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Our basic choices can also be identified as love or fear. In every moment, every decision, we're either expressing or experiencing love or fear. And as universal law says, what we put out is what we get back. So if we're putting fear into this river of divine fire, then we're going to get fear out of it. But if we're recognizing, hey, wait a minute, there could be a higher way of looking at this or another way of looking at it, you realize, oh, wait a minute, this is a new channel of new energy coming onto the earth plane that raises all to a higher level of vibration that in fact matches the vibration of Christ and the seraphim and all the other ascended beings. And that's the perspective I choose to look at. And I agree with you that it doesn't necessarily reference that this river of divine fire doesn't necessarily reference the arrival of an individual, but it instead represents a new consciousness. And a huge part of that consciousness is about our interconnection with not only our local star system, but other star systems, and all the way scaling up our connection all the way to the galactic center, especially.
That's right. On your blog, you have the story about the galactic center, the detection of a what's called a mysterious monster fountain of charged particles. I don't know if this is related to what was announced. Was it 2012 or even 2011? I forget now. But these bubbles, basically, it was depicted as two purple bubbles coming from the center of the galaxy.
That's right. Yeah, they call those the Fermi bubbles or the plasma bubbles from November 2010.
Right, was that far back? This must be related to some way to the same story.
It is related. I mean, we've been looking at the galactic center intently now for the past couple of decades, which is really incredible and represents our leap in consciousness. We're beginning to identify ourselves as citizens of the galaxy. We're now connected with that galactic center. We're learning about it. We're learning about it, its influence on us. And I talked about this in my recent book, The Secret of Sion, and also my DVD presentation, The Light of Sion, where we're looking towards the galactic center as, in fact, the throne of Christ, as the location of the heavenly Sion, which, according to the Bible, the book of Hebrews, is inhabited by just humans made perfect. In other words, humans who have achieved wholeness, holiness, completion, and perfection, and have transformed themselves into light beings. And we've been looking at the galactic center as the possible home for them and how that could be possible. And lo and behold, NASA just keeps coming up with all of these discoveries about the center of the galaxy. And most recently, they announced the discovery of this tower of star stuff coming out of the galactic center, which is amazing because it could be interpreted, the galactic center can be interpreted as the promised land, as the actual throne. And it's from that throne that this pillar or tower of light called the Shekinah glory would manifest from the Ark of the Covenant. So if the heavenly Ark of the Covenant is located at Christ's throne, as the Bible suggests, then maybe what we're seeing here is an example of the Ark pillar at a galactic level. And this is telling me, hey, this is our North Star. This is the direction we want to head towards.
So if we're talking about the same thing, how do you think the ancient people without potentially then, well, some argue that they did have technology, but if we exclude that, how could they see this? How could they notice? How did they, if you will, then go there to realize some of these things?
Good question. It's possible that they were shown it by the immovable race of the perfect light humans, this advanced race, the sons of God, the Elohim, the mighty race. Maybe they expanded their consciousness so that they were able to perceive it. Perhaps they were using some hallucinogenic substances. This is why the manna is such an important part of the kit, because it's clearly some kind of hallucinogenic star food. There's numerous examples I cite in the Judgment Day device of angels manifesting before prophets and encouraging them to eat a book or a scroll, also thought of as a roll, that expands their consciousness and enables them to achieve wisdom and maybe even to see God. So there's several ways that they could have known about it. Today, we're rediscovering it with the advent of advanced technology.
Yeah, we do. It's really interesting, exciting times. Let's tie in Solomon's temples in this as well. It was basically built to house the Ark, and then we have this whole scenario where Solomon's temples was demolished. It was attempted to be rebuilt at one stage, and then eventually, the Ark goes on a journey, right? And it's just basically set up in temporary locations in different tabernacles, I guess. But if we go back again to Solomon's temple, was that originally where it was that built to only house the Ark, or how do you view that temple?
Yes, Solomon's temple was built by King David's son Solomon as the permanent home for the Ark of the Covenant. Like the Ark, the Solomon's temple was constructed based upon a pattern or a blueprint given to Solomon by God. So it's another example of a heavenly technology that is now being duplicated on Earth. The interesting thing about Solomon's temple is that it was divided into two areas. It was divided into the holy place, which is kind of the outer part of the temple, and the most holy place. The holy place and the most holy place were separated by a veil. And the idea was is that that veil was covered with stars, and it was meant to symbolize the veil separating heaven and earth. So as the high priest and other individuals crossed over the veil, metaphorically and perhaps even literally, as I believe, they were crossing over from the world of matter into the immaterial world. And in fact, they wore special clothing. The high priest's clothing was made from the same material as that veil. And so that's telling me that, okay, if this veil is made of star stuff or symbolizes star stuff, then the garments that the high priest made on or put on before entering the most holy place were also made of star stuff. This could be some kind of a light body or star body transformation that we're talking about. And this is validated by what went on in the most holy place. The most holy place is where the Ark of the Covenant was housed, along with the other pieces of the kit, the Rod of Enlightenment, the flask of manna, the cruse of the sacred oil, and the other implements and tools, the tablets of the law that compose the complete Ark of the Covenant. The distinction between the holy place and the most holy place is this. Holy is something that we become. Most holy means that the objects or that golden cube-shaped room, which is what the most holy place looked like, could actually impart holiness to whatever entered into that space. So that means that when the high priest entered the most holy place, he was entering as a man, but he was transformed into a holy being or an angel as a result of his interaction with the Ark in this golden cube-shaped room. So what that tells me is that this most holy place with the Ark and all its implements was some kind of a transformation chamber. It was a chamber in which humans were transformed into angelic beings who could then phase back and forth between the material and the immaterial realm, between heaven and earth, and it also gave them the ability to interact with Yahweh, the Old Testament God, who is also one of these non-physical or energetic beings. Jesus, as I describe in the book, was a high priest of the order of Melchizedek. He would have been one of these figures who knew how to affect this transformation and who indeed would have entered the most holy place.
That's a very ancient Skype-type device that we're talking about.
A very ancient Skype. Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. But I think it's more than that. It's
sure,
not
sure.
Just a Skype, but in other words, you could interact and communicate with Yahweh through the Skype, but it was also a teleportation device. That's what we're talking about here, a Stargate device.
That's right. Now, do you think that the Ark then was disassembled at some point in history? And if so, could there be a people, let's say, like the Mandeans, who I know you write about, still could have possessed the knowledge, basically, on how to assemble the Ark again?
There's a specific name that's used historically for the guardians of the Ark of the Covenant. It is they who assemble it and disassemble it. They're called the Rainmakers. And as far as I can tell, this is a pun. And the pun goes something like this. You think of the Ark of the Covenant, you have to think of the rainbow energy that manifested from it. Again, Yahweh is described as rainbow-like. And in Judeo-Christian art, when you see the Ark of the Covenant, you'll very often see a rainbow arcing between the two cherubim on the mercy seat.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Rainbow is formed by three things: sun, water, and the person that sees it. And so in order for the water to manifest, you have the sun, and then the water manifests from the clouds, and the clouds bring rain. Well, it turns out whenever you see figures such as Enoch described in the heavenly realms, he's riding upon the clouds. Enoch will ride upon the clouds when he returns. When Christ returns, he rides upon the clouds, or the cloud, which is rather humorous since now we call the internet the cloud.
Right, yeah.
But this is the source of the pun. They're called the Rainmakers because the Messiah whom they serve, for whom they assembled this kit, this Christ or Messiah figure, rides upon the clouds, and the cloud brings rain. And what's in the rain, it could be a rain of manna, it can be a rain of this higher frequency or vibration, it could be literal raindrops, but that's why I believe they're called the rainmakers.
This might be a too kind of literal way, again, to interpret things, but I think it is interesting nonetheless that since we're looking at this, or you've mentioned so many times in the past, William, that there is a technological aspect to this, that a lot of the ancient magic, if you will, potentially could be explained with some of the technology that we're now developing, and the fact that we are, you know, we're currently involved in cloud seeding and effectively producing rain, becoming the rainmakers. This is, of course, a very literal interpretation of it, but I found this kind of funny nonetheless with HAARP and everything else that's going on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where this Kardashev scale becomes so imperative for us, because it clearly, in a speculative way anyway, it differentiates civilizations, type 0, type 1, type 2, type 3. And again, this is based on how these civilizations harvest the energy resources that power their civilization. And we're clearly type 0 because we're dependent on our fossil fuel. We've yet to go up to type 1 status, where we derive the majority of our energy from our local star, let alone we're not quite to the stage where we're colonizing our local star system, nor are we up to the type 3 status where we're harvesting the energy of the black hole at the galactic center. But we can clearly see that with our technological advancement, which comes from our expansion of consciousness, we're able to imagine these technologies and actually begin to manufacture them or create them. So that tells me that we're moving on up the scale. And as we do so, I think we're going to start to have more and more interactions with these type 2, type 3, and maybe even type 4 beings who have clearly been coming and going from this planet for a very long time.
Let's talk a little bit more about the shift of human perception, and I want to detail a bit more about this, how you feel that potentially just the seeking itself of the Ark actually could be a transforming experience. Do you think that this has to do with, again, then technology that might be sought in this process, or are we talking about a spiritual transformation as one begins to realize what the Ark actually is about?
Well, let me put it this way. One of the things that really surprised me about the complete Ark of the Covenant, which is the throne of the Second Coming, what I call the Judgment Day device. It's the Ark platform with the footstool, with the tree, with the jar of the oil, the flask of manna, the book, and the robe of light. What I've just described for you is exactly the empty throne of Buddha. In other words, the throne of the Second Coming, the complete throne of Christ, and the complete Ark of the Covenant, and let me say this, because I haven't stated this categorically, the complete and true cross of Christ includes the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant includes the cross of crucifixion. They're mm-hmm. the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying here, too, is that the throne of Buddha and the throne of the Second Coming are symbolically identical. I put them side by side in the book, and they are exactly the same thing. Now, here's the key point that answers your question. These symbols of the empty throne of Buddha represent the actual presence of Buddha. And as Buddhist initiates begin to assemble and be able to identify what these symbols mean, this represents their path to enlightenment. So by assembling these symbols and understanding them and being able to identify them with aspects of their consciousness, the Buddhist initiate understands that he is becoming Buddha-like. Now, Christians would never go along with this kind of concept that you can assemble the symbols of Christ and become more Christ-like. They draw the line at that, but it's clearly established in Buddhism. But there's a definite link between the empty throne of Buddha and the throne of Christ. And the really surprising thing that I put together in the book that I think is really, really revolutionary, in fact, is that what I show, Henrik, is that the throne of Buddha, with its symbolism, with the tree and the footstool and the throne, and the throne of Christ with the same tree and footstool and throne, are matched by the throne of Osiris, which was portrayed on the walls put on the walls by Ramses II at the Temple of Seti at Abydos. Well, the important thing about this is that this throne of Osiris is at least 1,500 years older. This symbolism is at least 1,500 years older than the depiction of the throne of Buddha or the throne of Christ, which means it must be the prototype for this complete ark throne cross device. So this takes us all the way back to ancient Egypt, and this is where, and I don't jump off this cliff, but I do mention it, it's possible that this symbolism was discovered at the Osirion, or in the Osirion, this mysterious temple behind the Temple of Seti at Abydos. People like John Anthony West, Robert Schock, Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall are all very comfortable in saying that the Osirion is at least 10,000 years old.
Yeah.
So if this symbolism was originally placed at Abydos and it was hauled out of the Osirion, then that means that this Judgment Day device that we're talking about, this complete Ark of the Covenant, the true Ark of the Covenant, dated back at least 10,000 years.
Mm.
It belongs to neither Jews, Christians, Muslims, or Buddhists, for that matter.
Right,
it's a
right.
universal symbol of this super advanced race that brought it here.
Very interesting. Now, let me tie back a little bit more here. I want to ask you more about the Judgment Day, and if you still in view that this is actually something that is to take place on one day, if you will, William. I mean, is this a? I know that you talk about technological singularity and things like that, and that would be literally something that would potentially happen over one day, instantaneously, pretty much. If we remain have a positive view of the Judgment Day, as you've been trying to detail and outline here, is that still something that would just happen over one day? And if there's anything we can do to, I guess, prepare for that, then, if anything.
Well, I think it could happen one day. I think there is a Judgment Day. We are all preparing for a Judgment Day in the sense that in the Egyptian model, at one day, if we subscribe to these religious beliefs, our heart will be weighed against the feather of cosmic truth. And there will be a judgment, a decision made about our soul's evolution, whether we need to come back into the earth plane, work out more karma or whatever, or if we can continue on our spiral of evolution, move on into higher dimensional realms. So there definitely will be a judgment day for all of us. Is it an actual specific day where the human collective will experience this at one time? I can't say that, and I think of it more in terms of a window. I mean, in a way, historically speaking, I mean, and authors do this all the time. You're reading books, and they'll say, well, we think this happened between 1000 BC and 1300 BC,
right,
as if that's all the same time period. That's like saying everything that's happened since 1470 and up to today in January 2013 are basically the same time. It's the same day, if you will. And cosmically speaking, 300 years is a blink of an eye. It's nothing. So will there be a specific day? Possibly, but I think more what we're talking about here is an accelerated time period, and that's what we're entering into now, is this time of incredible acceleration, and anything is possible because of that.
Well, that's right. I mean, you write in the book that we are on the verge of tremendous transformation, and also you reference that there is a new center at Cambridge now basically looking into extinction-level things that we might develop ourselves, basically, from biotechnology to artificial intelligence. So that kind of thinking is more or less on the map at this stage.
It is. We've come to the realization ever since we've had the bomb that, hey, we can blow ourselves to kingdom come. We can end all this in the blink of an eye. And there are scientists that are saying, wait a minute, we got to put the brakes on this because some of this is runaway technology. We don't know the ramifications. I mean, we're just beginning now to realize that GMO foods are not such a good thing. And it's probably too late to do anything about that. And this is why they're raising the alarm bells on some of these Judgment Day device technologies that can go completely beyond our control in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's true. And, go back to that idea, I guess that's also one of the reasons why it's more important than ever that we, basically become conscious of what we're doing and where we're heading, because that would be, if we're heading mindlessly into this, if that level of awareness is not there, it could indeed end overnight, basically. But we have to have that awareness, and that awareness needs to be raised, on the planet, so we know at least people who are in these positions understand the consequences of it. Otherwise, we might be doomed.
Exactly. And that, again, gets back to my point in writing a book. When I heard that Ahmadinejad, President Ahmadinejad of Iran, believes he can hasten or accelerate the Judgment Day, the end times, the arrival of the Mahdi, by creating global chaos, and that this figure will be introduced or be symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant, that really woke me up. I'm thinking, well, most people have no idea about this.
Yeah.
And we need to at least have some awareness about this, because in following this path, as we've done in these past couple hours, we realize, hey, wait a minute, there's a lot more to this subject than meets the eye. This isn't some Indiana Jones movie we're talking about here. You know, we're talking about potentially situations and revelations that can change humanity in a profoundly positive way if it's handled correctly.
Indeed. Well, it's fascinating. It's a very interesting subject matter. And again, as I said before, William, you've tied a lot of interesting threads together in this, and it really dovetails so much with your other previous books. It's really like it's a big series of books really, and you're on a path. You're obviously onto the trail here of finding what ties together the ancient past and basically where we're going in the future. Where is this going next, William?
Well, I'm going to continue, especially with the Path of Souls work. I'm so fascinated. I live in Nashville, and I've recently learned of the work of a local neurosurgeon named Dr. Arthur Cushman, who talks about how ancient Nashville was a place where people would come from all over America. The Native Americans would come here to learn the Path of Souls. And what that meant was they learned how to jump into the Milky Way and cross through the Gate of Orion and make it to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. This was taught here as artifacts evidence over 1,000 years ago here in Nashville. And it so fascinated me because, one, the concept is incredible, but it also matched up with what I've been seeing in all this other Last Judgment art that we described earlier, of these serpentine pathways that could symbolize wormholes linking Earth with the galactic center. And the Path of Souls is the path that puts us on the place of ascension, where we gain awareness of our true spiritual capabilities, where we go to specific places, where we receive teachings that enable us to access these stargates and wormholes, maybe even to, at the time of our transition, to travel through Orion all the way to the galactic center. So I'm on that path right now of researching this. It's including a lot of work on the near-death experience and what people experience in that, with the tunnel of light being the wormhole, and also the possibility that cultures in the past have left us maps for the afterlife, how we become what they refer to as successful souls, resurrected souls, perfect souls that know how to travel the galaxy as beings of light.
Do you believe, William, that I've heard some people argue that basically going out into space, going off planet, basically is part of this ascension process? That it's like you graduate from the school of Earth, at least, and manage to take yourself further out, maybe even actually progressing towards the center of the galaxy. Who knows what the true purpose is? But do you think that aspect of gaining that type of control, as you said before, as a type one or two level civilization, that you can utilize space travel, but is that part of the ascension process, do you think?
Yes, I firmly believe that it is, and that's in large part what I'm working on now, is piecing together that aspect of the story.
All right, very interesting. Thank you again, William. Let's mention your website again, and of course remind us about the events that you have upcoming that you're both attending and organizing, William.
Right, thank you. My website is williamhenry.net, and I can be reached there if anybody has any questions, or if they want to order the book, The Judgment Day Device, the book or the DVD, you can do that there. And I hope you'll think about joining us here in Nashville in April 20th and 21st for the Path of Souls, where we tap into our divine self, assemble the ascension kit, and achieve what I call awesome holiness, based on an interview, actually, I heard with Jenny McCarthy, of all people, one time. I hope that you might also think about joining us May 17th through the 19th here in Nashville for the Revelation Symposium featuring Graham Hancock, Whitley Strieber, and me for a wonderful weekend of intense presentations by the three of us, plus a fourth mystery guest who I'll be announcing here shortly.
Right, very good. And are there any specific websites for this, or can we just go to williamhenry.net and click into events to get this?
Yeah, you can. Well, you can visit Graham Hancock's website, grahamhancock.com, or Whitley's website, unknowncountry.com, or especially williamhenry.net. Click on the banner for the Revelation Symposium, the unveiling, or the Path of Souls, and join us. I should also mention I've got a tour of Rennes-le-Château, France, coming up May 1st through the 10th as well. It's called Doorways into Other Dimensions. We'll be going to southern France, spending 9 days seeking the portals of the Rennes-le-Château area.
All right. Keeping busy. Good stuff. Much coming up. And again, then just head on over to williamhenry.net, clicking on events if you want to read more about that. And again, the book is called The Judgment Day Device. Check it out for more on what we've been talking about here today. Very fascinating stuff. All right, well, we'll wrap up for this time. Thank you again for joining us, William. Really appreciate it, and take good care.
My pleasure, Henrik. Thank you for having me, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
We have some great guests in the pipeline, like Paul Levy, Mikael Jalving, a roundtable on Egypt with Chris Dunn, Stephen Mailer, and Brian Forrester. We also have Josh Reeves, Mark Safer, Bill Donahue, and Danny Wilton lined up for later. My thanks to Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. We hope you have a great rest of your day, evening, or night, and we will talk to you in just a few. Bye-bye.